Welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. My name is Claire Shorenstein, and I am a board-certified sports dietitian and runner based in Santa Cruz, California. I provide virtual nutrition services to teenage and adult athletes of all abilities, and I host this podcast to demonstrate that there is no one-size-fits-all nutrition approach towards optimal health and performance. Today, I have fellow sports dietitian Alisa Lieb of Peak to Peak Nutrition, who is joining me to discuss sports nutrition for mountain athletes. Alisa herself is a trail runner and climber, and I thought it would be really fun to chat about how nutrition for climbers compares to nutrition for trail runners, because as you can imagine, many of the nutrition concepts are the same, but the logistics and practical considerations are very, very different. Personally, I've climbed a few times in the gym and I've worked with many climbers, but it's definitely not my sport. And I'm always eager to feature dietitians who specialize in slightly different niches than mine. So I am really excited for today's topic. I hope you enjoy it. And as always, I love hearing from my listeners. So if you'd like to get in touch for any reason, whether it's feedback, topic requests, questions for an Ask Me Anything episode or whatever else, please reach out. You can reach me at my website, eatforendurance.com, or shoot me an email over at claire@eatforendurance.com. All right. So here's my episode with Alisa Lieb, all about nutrition for mountain athletes with a focus on climbers. Alisa, welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. How's your day treating you so far?
It's been going well. You know, we got a spring thunderstorm or thunder snowstorm this weekend. Oof. And the mountain's finally starting to melt. So
okay. And you're out in Colorado, right?
I am. Yep. Front Range of Colorado.
Awesome. Awesome. Before we dive into today's topic, I always like to have my dietitians share a little background on themselves, both as a dietitian and also as an athlete. And I know you're both of those. So yeah, why don't you fill us in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the history of both the athlete and the dietitian piece sort of intertwine a little bit. But I guess the long story short is I grew up playing soccer, really switched to running as a priority in college when I no longer had a soccer team to take up my time. And then that sort of spiraled. I've always been really interested in the outdoors. I grew up in Appalachia, hiking all the time on the AT. And I moved to Colorado after college and just really leaned into the outdoor sports. At the time, I was injured and not running, but I was doing a ton of hiking. I started rock climbing. And during this time, I really started to become aware of just how common this, like, lighter is better, lose weight to climb harder, to run faster culture was in the communities that I was a part of. And that combined with just some sort of personal things that were going on in my professional life at that point, all just sort of spiraled into me deciding to go back to school and be a dietitian as a second career. So that was a very, very long process.
I can attest to that.
Yes, and you're well aware of that. I hadn't taken a science class since like 11th grade. So that was very fun to take, you know, Bio 101 and all of that stuff. So I ended up going back to school, just really wanted to be a positive voice in the outdoor sports communities to help people realize that actually, if you fuel your body, you're going to perform a lot better than if you restrict and try to keep your body as small as possible.
Totally, totally. And, you know, you mentioned to me when just kind of providing some information on yourself ahead of our interview that, you know, you have your own private practice, right? And you're also a staff dietitian for Uphill Athlete. I haven't heard of that, but you can share a little bit about that role, because one of the things I know we wanted to mention is how they for a while were promoting fasted training as a way of improving fat adaptation, and you were kind of opposing that, and they kind of switched their stance, and maybe you can kind of speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, totally. So I'm the staff dietitian at Uphill Athlete. Uphill Athlete is a training organization first and foremost for uphill athletes. So it's predominantly trail runners and mountaineers, ski mountaineers, some rock climbers. Which is a really fun kind of niche to work in, because there is, and you know, we'll get into this so much more today, but there's a lot of overlap with nutrition recommendations for sports like running, but then there are so many other practical considerations that are just totally different from running. I've been at Uphill for about 6 months now, if that's how the math works. So I wasn't there during sort of their birth of recommendations around fasted training. So, you know, I won't try to speak to that. I know at the time there was some indication that that was an appropriate way to be training to improve endurance. But ultimately, what ended up happening was the founder, Steve House, basically, you know, he and the other coaches started to notice there was more and more research coming out saying, hey, actually, fasted training is not the move. This is something that does not come without risk. And between that and just sort of anecdotal evidence from talking to athletes, the realization really became, we don't even know if fasted training is actually benefiting anyone anyway. And so they have really made a big effort, you know, over the last few months to try to basically do a 180 when it comes to that recommendation. So there are a couple of articles coming out from the dietitian who preceded me there. She did an excellent job writing a couple of articles, really going into a deep dive of the physiology and the science behind, hey, why was fasted training recommended in the first place? And B, why did that not really pan out the way that it was supposed to? So it's been really cool being a part of, you know, this team as we've really kind of shifted the recommendations, you know, away from this, what we now know to be harmful recommendation around fasted training.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you for explaining that. I also am definitely not promoting fasted training, obviously, among my athletes, and definitely talk about kind of how if it's not harming you, I mean, at the best case scenario, it's doing nothing and not helping you, right? So what's kind of the point? But in most cases, it's not. It's doing more than just not helping you, right? So, but anyway, so I mean, you clearly specialize in working with mountain athletes, right? And so that would include, yeah, trail running, climbing, and winter sports like skiing, ski mountaineering. And I guess we can kind of see, I always love with dietitians, like see where the discussion takes us, right? But I really want to focus today, as we discussed, on nutrition for climbing, because that's something I haven't yet covered on the show. And I also thought it'd be really interesting to compare and contrast nutrition for trail running and climbing, because of course there are many similarities in terms of the general concepts that we use, but obviously there are such huge differences when it comes to kind of logistics and practical considerations, like with any sport, when you're transitioning from one sport to another, right? So I thought it'd be really fun to kind of go through that. So maybe to start, we can zoom out and kind of take the 10,000 foot view first. And maybe you can explain what are some common nutrition themes and challenges that you observe across all of your mountain athletes, you know, and how are you working on these things with your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I'm sure there's a lot of overlap here with what you see in the athletes that you work with. I would say far and away, the number one challenge that I see is just not eating enough, underfueling, which is just so, so common. And, you know, I think importantly, it's often not intentional. And I think, you know, and I'm sure this is something that you've bumped into as well, that a lot of the time athletes will think, oh, well, you know, that's not my problem. I'm eating enough. I'm doing fine. But they just don't realize exactly what their nutrition needs are. They, you know, don't realize what some of those signs are, those more subtle signs that you're not eating enough. And so they think, well, you know, I've maintained my weight. I'm getting through my workouts. Like I eat all the time. We're good. It's not necessarily the result of intentional restriction, although sometimes that of course can happen. Yeah, I would say that is far and away the top issue that I run into with my mountain athletes.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's kind of the theme across like most of these episodes I have. Everyone says that. And I ask all the dietitians I have on here, because this comes up so frequently, how do you help athletes realize if they are eating enough? Because I think eating enough is, and I've said this many times before, eating enough is often difficult for people to grasp, especially when we're not counting calories. We may not have access to, you know, getting an RMR test and that kind of stuff. So moving day to day and living a busy life and just being a recreational athlete or whatever, how are you helping athletes kind of answer that question that is often tough, especially when it's not an intentional restriction, right?
Yeah. So I practice a big framework behind my practice is based in intuitive eating, which, you know, really centers around listening to your body. Your body knows what's up. And so that's the approach that I end up taking with athletes is, you know, yes, you are eating all of the time, but how do you feel? How is your recovery? Are you insanely sore for 4 days after a hard workout? You know, that's an indication, you know, looking at things like just changes in your skin or your hair or your fingernails. These can all be indicators. Sleep, mood as well. You know, if you're under fueling, even if you don't realize, maybe you start to become a little more irritable, a little anxious, feeling a little depressed. And just really sort of going down that checklist of paying attention to a lot of things that in our current society, we don't really pay that much attention to.
Yeah, no, for sure. And yeah, I'm going to put a pin in the intuitive eating because we'll kind of circle back to that. And I know that's something, you know, we'll talk about for sure. Let's talk about what are the similarities when it comes to nutrition and approaching, talking about nutrition, when it comes to trail running and climbing. So what are, like, obviously eating enough, fueling enough, that's like the big common theme. And maybe you can identify other similarities across your mountain athletes, but when we're kind of zooming in a little bit, what are the kind of common things you're working on between those sports?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it, you know, ultimately the nutrition science doesn't change, right? Yeah. We know that during exercise, we need a pretty constant stream of carbohydrate in order to fuel muscle contractions and maintain blood sugar. So all of that really stays the same. I would say, you know, when we're talking like mountaineering, generally, my recommendations for that type of activity are basically the same as with trail running. We want to be, you know, fueling pretty much as our gut will tolerate, multiple times an hour, focusing on carbs on really long days, making sure to incorporate some protein in there. But then we start to get into some of the logistical side of things, right? So you're climbing a mountain, you're going to be out there for 15 hours, 3 days, however long it is, you have to carry everything. And that has been, I think, the most interesting thing that I love working on is really trying to find that balance where you're getting in enough carbs, but you're also not carrying 80,000 tons of weight up a mountain. I recently worked with an athlete who is planning a, where is he going? He's doing an Antarctic crossing,
which
is wild to think about. So he's going to be out there for, I think like 2 or 3 months and has all of his nutrition plan totally dialed. And basically when we sat down together, he said, this is how much weight I can carry in food. That's it. I cannot bring more.
Figure it out.
So it really is this game of, okay, make sure you're meeting your protein needs for recovery. And then let's get in as many carbs as we possibly can. And then fill in the rest with fat because fat, you know, of course is more calorie dense, so you don't have to carry as much of it to get the same number of calories. That's always an interesting sort of thing to consider there. When we're thinking more along the lines of rock climbing, you know, there are a lot of sort of day-to-day logistics. For example, if you're in the middle of a climb, eating is not very practical. So really planning out, okay, you eat your snack when you get to the top of the pitch after you're anchored in, and you're making sure that you're eating in a way that you're not just dropping your food off the side of the wall. Also balancing, you know, gut issues and urination as well, because that is not.
I have so many questions surrounding. I have like a million questions about climbing. And I mean, I think it's also, I mean, we say like mountaineering or even the sport of like running or even trail running, there are like a million sports within that sport, you know? So like, you know, what you were saying about mountaineering and the multi, I mean, I've also like your Antarctic guy, like I've worked with, you know, ultra runners doing multi-day, like stage race type things. And it's a similar thing. It's like, I can't carry all this stuff, right? Versus say like someone who's running a 50 mile race or even a 100 mile and they have like crews and they have all this stuff where like carrying things isn't an issue. And that's where the logistical stuff comes into play. But like even more so, like, I mean, I am not a climber. I've like, you know, rock climbed in a gym a couple times. This is not my sport. I do not know. I've worked with some climbers, but my own like experience with it is so limited. So I find it fascinating because yeah, like, what do you, okay, this is a stupid question. What do you do if you have to go to the bathroom and you're like on a rock while in a mountain or whatever, just like pee yourself? Like, and then GI issues. I'm throwing a lot of things at you. I'm sorry. But again, this is like my mind. I'm just all over the place here. Like, I think to myself, GI issues are so prevalent in my endurance athletes. Like, almost nearly every one of my one-to-one clients right now has some form of GI stuff going on who come to me with problems. It's like, Jesus, like, I would not want to have to like poop on a wall. Like, what do you do? Yeah. Let's start there. Cause I just threw like 1,000 questions at you. Sorry.
What do you
Sorry,
do?
My brain's like firing all over the place. Like, oh my God. Okay. So yeah. What do you do if you have to go to the bathroom on a rock wall? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, totally. So I'll preface this with GI issues. I find to be a lot less of an issue in climbers than I do in more like endurance type athletes.
Okay. Runners, that's good to know.
There's a little less like gut jostling.
Yeah.
The emergency bathroom break is much less of a thing.
Okay.
So for the most part, and obviously there are like emergency situations, but for the most part, when we talk about pooping on a wall, we're really talking about big wall climbing where you are going up for multiple days. You are camping in a portal edge on the side of the wall. There is a thing called a poop tube. I'm not going to go into more details than that, but because
I think so there is a device. There is something you use. Okay, great.
I mean, device is a strong word to use for it. It's sort of
a bag,
like a DIY situation.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So that's a move. You know, like wag bags are.
But then you have to like carry your poop. I guess you just have to like carry it around with you.
Yeah. Yep. You carry.
Oh, that's fun. nice.
And I think the thing too.
More is weight.
Well, and that's something that this is like tangentially related, but I saw a post on Reddit the other day for somebody who is doing the PCT, and there's a zone around Mount Whitney, you might know because you're in California, where you are required to bring a wag bag and pack out your poop. And so this post was basically saying, hey, how can I do the PCT and detour to climb Whitney and then not have to carry my poop for another 100 miles?
You can't like bury it or something. I'm so used to trail running. Like, there's just so much poop everywhere, anyways. Like, I don't know, like animal poop. I mean, it's just so, again, these things, this is where my mind goes. Cause with trail running, it's like you just pop in the woods, find a tree, whatever, you know, do your business, wipe with a leaf, you know, move on.
Yeah.
But it's a little more complicated.
Like certain zone because Mount Whitney is so popular.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Sure. Okay. That's funny. Okay, I know we're like totally going on a major tangent here. This has been always my big question about climbing. It's like, what do you do if you have to go to the bathroom? Okay, obviously there are bigger things to take into account in nutrition. We're getting super sidetracked. Okay, so the main thing we're thinking about here is we'll take a step back. The main thing is that you really have to carry all the stuff. And obviously there are short climbs where maybe you don't have, like, much like with a shorter run or bike ride or whatever, like, maybe you just feel really well going into it and you eat your snack at the top kind of situation. And then there are longer climbs where you really have to be better prepared. So I guess my question is, like, what about, because I know with running and other sports, even, you know, skiing, whatever, where you have your stuff with you, like, even when you're doing, like, something for 2 hours, you're fueling. Is it the same in climbing? Are people open to that? Are they more resistant because they have to literally carry it up a, you know, their climbing route? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So I think it depends. Isn't that always the answer for things?
Always. Yes.
So when we think about kind of the different like types of climbing, and, you know, kind of thinking about like an easier climbing day. So there, you know, and this is probably the most common form of climbing is just called cragging. And it's the idea where you hike into an area, depending on where you are, it can be like a 5-minute hike. Like you can look down and be like, there's my car. It's right there.
Sure.
And you basically just set up shop at the base of a bunch of climbs. So at the base of a wall and you're climbing one route, it could take anywhere from, you know, 2 minutes to half an hour. And then you're coming back down onto the ground. So that's extremely common. And obviously in that situation, it's going to be a lot easier to eat more because you have all of your stuff just like right there at the base. You carried it for 5 minutes, no big deal. You have bouldering, which is, you know, climbing, I don't know, like 15-foot rocks basically. And so that's sort of a similar idea where, you know, you're on the wall for 2 seconds to 2 minutes. And you can always put that down and there's food there.
Excuse me. Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry.
Then you get into multi-pitch climbing. So where you're climbing like multiple rope links, that's where you're actually like hanging out on the wall for a little bit longer. You don't just immediately come back down. You're climbing up, you know, a rope length is, you know, a typical rope is like a 70 meter rope. You know, so your pitch can be anywhere from like 50 feet to whatever 70 meters is in feet. Yep. I can't math that way.
Yeah, I don't know.
And anyway, so, you know, in those situations, you're going to be on the wall for a little bit longer. You've got this obvious sort of break point at when you get to the end of that rope. And then you, you know, build an anchor, you tie into that, and now you're just kind of hanging on the side of the wall, but you're not actively climbing. What was the question that got us started on this?
Oh, in terms of, like, fueling. So, like how, like in, let's take running for an instance, like, you know, you can run for, like, say you're doing an easy run and you're, maybe you're not fueling or anything and you have shorter and longer climbs similarly. So like with running, for instance, if someone's doing like a 90 minute or 2 hour run, like we're fueling that. So I was trying to see, like, obviously we know that from just nutrition science and the same principles, like you benefit from that, but in practical, like in actual real life, in the culture of climbing, because it differs, right? Like, how does that actually translate, right? So yeah. It sounds like with the, I don't know what you were calling it, with the pitch. Sorry, I don't have all the terminology to climbing. But when you have the pitch and you're, it sounds like these longer climbs, and I don't know, like, in terms of hours, what we're talking here, what the range is, because, I mean, you mentioned, like, a 15-hour climb. So I don't know if with the ropes, like, are you, is it as short as, like, 2 or 3 hours ever with ropes, or is it always much longer? Like, so, and yeah. And, yeah. Okay. Totally. And then, so yeah. It is shorter. Okay.
Could be really anywhere from, like, you know, half an hour to a whole day to multiple days.
Got it. Okay, yeah, got it.
To that point, you know, yes, the recommendation would be to be eating on those shorter climbs. Is that really a part of the culture? I like to think it's changing, but that could also be kind of the bubble that I'm in. You know, I definitely think like having some snacks at the crag. So when you're there just doing like a short pitch and then coming back to the ground immediately after. I think snacking is fairly common. For those climbing days, for the longer climbing days where you are on the wall for a long time and you are carrying a lot of things, there's definitely some resistance to that. You know, both from a having to carry it perspective, but then also just from the practicality of, you know, sometimes on a multi-pitch climb, you get to this really nice ledge. And so you can, you know, sit down and hang out for a little bit and like take out a snack and it's easy to eat. Sometimes you are literally dangling off the side of the wall and it's very uncomfortable to be there. And then, you know, if you drop something, that's not good if there's a party climbing below you. So,
yeah.
So as so far what,
as, yeah, oh, go ahead.
As far as the nutrition recommendations go, I always try to work with my climbers and encourage them, you know, in between your pitches, in between your climbs, like when you get to that point where you're on the ledge, that's when you should be eating. I will say, like, I think for a lot of climbers, that is not what they think about.
Yeah. I mean, I have, as I said, I have worked with a handful of climbers. It's definitely not my specialty. And I've worked with a handful of, you know, people doing Skimo and stuff like that. And there's a lot more resistance within those sports than, say, my runners, my cyclists, my triathletes. And I think part of it is, it might be a culture thing. It might also just be logistics and access. You know, because like it's just, you know, especially if you're all bundled up and things aren't as like accessible and you don't have your hands free. And like, it's just like a different thing than say you can literally run and eat and drink at the same time. It's just a lot easier. So I was curious about that. What about like the gear? Like, are people wearing like hydration like vests and that type of stuff? Like with, you know, what kinds of things are they actually like gear wise using? And what do you typically recommend? For like not for like the sports where you literally basically have an aid station up on the ground, like not like that's kind of like easy, right? But for things where you're literally carrying everything, what are you typically seeing for that?
So with mountaineering, we see some use of hydration packs. A lot of that is going to depend on temperature, basically. You know, a lot of mountaineering is done at really high altitude where it's really cold, and no matter what you do, that hose is going to freeze. Rock climbing with hydration is not really a thing. You know,
oh, really?
No, well, not like with a vest.
Okay. So what do they carry?
Yeah. So it's typically like a Nalgene. You know, if somebody brings a backpack, they'll put a bottle in there. I've seen like some of the smaller Nalgenes. There are ways that you can basically clip them onto your harness. So you have it there. But with climbing, it becomes a little bit of a challenge too, because in some situations you have to use your entire body to get up the wall. And so if you're like wedged into a chimney and you have fluid on your back, that isn't going to work.
Yeah. But how does that work with, okay, like I'm thinking old school Nalgenes and of course, like, yeah, climbing, but like the old school, like really hard plastic, big things that are probably like swinging around. Like how, I mean, again, I'm asking all these logistical questions, but I'm genuinely curious, like, like that probably is really annoying too, because it's kind of, is that throwing you off balance if something's like hanging on you like that? Or no?
So with climbing, typically you're carrying a ton of stuff on your harness anyway. So like gear basically that you plug into the wall. Yeah. So it's just a bunch of stuff kind of bouncing around.
So you're just used to that. Got it. Yeah. I mean, it's I imagine it's really tricky, and you climb too, right? You do all these different things. Yeah. So you get it. So it's like, and this is why I feel like it's so important. Or just not that like you can't counsel people not being in the sport, but it just adds this extra level of understanding, because you yourself are experiencing these challenges of like what it's like being limited by what you can carry and what it's like having this gear kind of hanging around in the bottle, like whatever, you know? So you get it versus someone like me, like, I don't know what that's like, you know, I don't climb rocks and things. I really don't. So I really do think there's an extra benefit of like being in that sport and really getting it, to be able to give clients like that extra level of really specialized advice, right? Versus kind of more generalized like nutrition themes and, oh, this is a great suggestion, but in real life, it doesn't work. So I think that's really interesting. What are some other like practical, logistical, whatever considerations that are very specific to climbing that you want listeners to be aware of? And maybe it's like different types of products you might see people use, like compared to say something like running or triathlon or whatever else. Like maybe maybe people are going less for like gels or things, you know, like what are they going for? Or maybe again, it's gear related or just other strategies, things that that might be interesting or important to know.
Yeah, this is actually something that I feel pretty strongly about. So in climbing, you know, I mentioned that obviously there's a little bit less jostling. There's a lot less jostling than something like running. And so your body can tolerate more real foods. So I would say, you know, probably the most common like snack in quotes that I see climbers end up eating is a sandwich. You know, you can just pull out a sandwich and eat it on the wall, which is pretty cool. But I think at the same time, you know, I think a lot of climbers, they really are just kind of focused on, okay, I'm going to eat my sandwich for lunch. And, you know, that's kind of it. Maybe I'll have a bar here and there. But for the most part, they're not really fueling a whole lot. So this is actually an area where I think I've tried to kind of bring some trail running nutrition into climbing nutrition. I said, hey, you know, like, why don't we, you know, bring a gel? It's easy to get down. You know, you don't really have to worry about dropping it off the side of the wall. Obviously it could happen, but it's not, you know, you're not sitting there holding on to your pieces of sandwich, like, you know, opening the bag.
Yeah.
So you rip off the top, you squeeze it in, you're good to go. So I think, you know, that's definitely an area where I have been trying to get more climbers on board, just because they are really convenient. It's a really easy way to get in more fuel. Another thing, and this is really more on like the mountaineering side of things versus rock climbing. But really just, and you had mentioned this earlier, the issue of like gloves and having to deal with that. You know, this, and just other issues like related to the temperature piece,
or elevation like, or yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and I think obviously like it gets cold trail running sometimes too. And so, but I always encourage anyone who's going to be somewhere where it's cold, put your food in the freezer, see how it does if it's that cold. And if it freezes, if it's going to break your teeth off, if you cannot squeeze that gel out of the container, that's something that you need to keep on an inside pocket close to your body and just have a rotation going. Okay, I just ate the gel from the inside pocket. I'm going to move one from the outside pocket, put it in my jacket so I have it available the next time. And then just really thinking about realistically things that you can eat when you have big bulky gloves on. That can be a challenge. So, you know, pre-opening packets if you need to, you know, doing anything so that you don't have to take those gloves off. Because in some of these temperatures where mountaineers are going, you know, if you expose skin to the air for like 2 seconds, you're done.
How do you like pre-open a package though and like not have it, like obviously you can't really do that with a gel, it'll squeeze everywhere and create a mess, right? So like, I mean, I guess people are using their teeth or like creative with like doing stuff, but I mean, yeah, that really is like the resistance really is just like stopping. There's a lot of also, oh, well, my friends aren't doing it, so I don't want to stop and make the whole group stop. So it's a culture thing. It's what your friends are doing. There's just like a lot of factors that play into whether or not people fuel. But the gloves. what are some good glove foods, would you say?
Just thinking about like, gosh, I recommend Bobo's bars all the time because they don't freeze because they're already just rocks. Opening them ahead of time and then you just can sort of pick it up with, gloves and just kind of like shove it in your face. Those are really good options. You know, repackaging stuff into like a Ziploc bag. Normally, you know, even with like pretty bulky mountaineering mitts, you can like get a Ziploc open and then just sort of like pour it into your mouth.
I know repackaging things, like, I mean, that was even big for like the multi-day trail running thing where like, again, all those, the packages things come in, like that's just not going to work for weight. So when you have to really think about every single gram that's going on your back, like you have to be so specific about how you're packing all that stuff. So I know people are already doing that stuff. I know that you just, it wasn't climbing, but you said you just got back from a week of, was it ski, like a ski tour or what did you do?
It was just resort skiing. I was in.
Resort skiing. Okay. Yeah. So you weren't like carrying all your stuff and doing this kind of thing. Have you done anything like that before where you're like kind of carrying everything you need? Like what types of climbs do you do?
Yeah. So I have done, I'm not like a super like intense mountaineer with anything. I've never been on a rock climb that's lasted longer than a day. I've done like a multi-pitch, but I haven't,
sure.
I haven't slept in a portal ledge. I don't think that's for me.
That sounds scary.
on the like mountaineering side of things, I've done some like multi-day climbs in like, to be fair, pretty okay weather. and then as far as ski touring goes, I've just done like single day trips. So, you know, nothing that's like too wild. But you know, it definitely is like a consideration because if I'm out and especially with that sort of group dynamic, like, okay, well the group is going to move fast. And so I need to A, not be stopping very often. I need to B, make sure that I'm not carrying more weight that'll slow me down and then make me the one slowing down.
Today's show is brought to you by my self-paced course, Peak Performance for Endurance Athletes, your ultimate guide to strategic fueling. This 7-part series is packed with evidence-based, easy-to-understand information with tons of visuals covering everyday nutrition, hydration, intra-workout fueling, training the gut, performance, and micronutrient supplementation, and preparing for race day. Grab the link to my course in the show notes or on my website, eatforendurance.com, and once you're there, you can preview the first part of the module, check out the course curriculum, and read the detailed facts page. If you don't want or need a full course, I'm also selling several of the downloads from the course separately. They're essentially mini ebooks on a variety of performance and everyday nutrition topics. You can get each one for just $5 to $10, and I also have a discounted bundle available. And lastly, if you're interested in one-to-one nutrition coaching, I have some openings for new clients starting in mid-April. You can fill out a new client inquiry form and schedule a free 10-minute call on my website if you're interested. All right, let's get back to our episode.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, what are the lessons you've learned? Obviously everyone's different with what they do. And as dietitians, like, I mean, I can say for myself, like, I know what to do and I don't always do it, although I certainly try my best. It's all real life for human beings, but, I'm curious kind of what are the lessons you've learned about yourself, especially when it is more of a group dynamic or you are out there for a day is still a long time to be active and you have to account for all these things going on. So yeah, I'm curious to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think this kind of goes along with like, I know what to do, but I don't always do it, but really like advocating for myself, right? And recognizing I know that if I don't eat enough on this time or whatever it is that we're doing, I'm going to feel like crap. And so I need to do what I have to do to get that fuel in. And so if that means saying, hey guys, I'm going to stop for 2 minutes, I'm going to eat my snack, I'll catch up, and then catching up or doing my best, then, you know, it kind of is what it is. And that's what I have to do. I think the other big piece that I learned pretty quickly is to basically not carry too much water.
I know, interesting.
Hydration is such a tricky thing because, you know, we all need to be adequately hydrated. And, you know, all the statistics, like a 2% loss of body weight in fluid causes performance declines. So staying on top of hydration is super important, but there becomes this sort of crossover point, I guess, where, you know, maybe I do need 5 liters of water today, but if by carrying 5 liters of water, it causes me to use extra energy, now I'm digging myself into this calorie hole just for being extra hydrated. So there becomes this kind of crossover point where you sort of have to say, okay, this is the amount of water that I can get by on. And maybe it's not ideal, but, you know, it is what it's going to be. And if I carry more than that, then I start to see, you know, declining returns, basically.
Yeah. And that like really just points to, I mean, I know with any of my winter athletes that I work with, or really with anybody, you know, we're really making sure you're going into whatever big effort you're doing really well fueled, really well hydrated. Like I was working with someone doing ski mountaineering, and it wasn't that long, maybe it was like 2 or 3 hours, and it was a group setting. And again, she wasn't stopping as much as she probably would have had she been on her own. And so we just really made sure she had like an extra solid breakfast and was really well hydrated, you know, day before going in, all that stuff. And then did a really good job rehydrating and refueling and all that stuff. So, you know, it just gives you a little bit more buffer. Obviously in an ideal world, we'd be getting it all in during, but sometimes again, logistics, practicality, like doesn't really allow for that. So yeah, that I definitely understand. What is there anything else about climbing in particular that actually I wanted to ask, sorry, before I go there. What about sports drinks? Is that something that's popular in the climbing community? Is that making its way into Nalgene's? Is it plain water? Like what are people doing there?
You definitely see like scratch and tailwind in the mountaineering community. In the rock climbing community, not so much.
Interesting. Why is that?
I'm not sure. You know, and I think there's, it's interesting kind of like being in between. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap between mountaineering and climbing, but they are also like two very separate cultures. And, you know, and I was thinking earlier just around some of the cultural aspects of, you know, mountaineering nutrition. And, you know, historically, mountaineers would bring a block of cheese and a thing of pepperoni, and that was their fuel.
It's a lot of fat and some protein. Yeah.
You know, because it's easy to carry. You know, so we still see quite a lot of that where, you know, well, I'm, you know, going on my ski tour and I usually eat some blocks of cheese. So that's super interesting to think about. But yeah, as far as the sports drinks go, I'm not really sure why it hasn't made its way to climbing, because certainly, you know, I've been out in climbs where it's 100 degrees and, you know, you need those electrolytes. You're sweating a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, unless they're eating really salty food or something like that. Yeah. As you said, it's not like you aren't sweating. You're still, maybe people are sweating less than say running or some other sports, but, and obviously it's such an individualized thing anyways, but I'm kind of surprised that people aren't doing that. So that's a really interesting one.
I think with rock climbing too, you know, and I even hear this from climbers, you know, people will think, oh, well, you know, it's just rock climbing. It's not really exercise, which is, you know, could not be further from the truth.
It looks pretty hard to me.
It's hard to study, but actually the studies that have used like a metabolic cart to basically figure out how many calories are we actually burning rock climbing, it's pretty comparable to running.
Interesting.
As far as like the time that we actually spend climbing. Now, obviously, like with climbing, you spend a lot of time like hanging out in between climbs, like belaying, which burns calories, but not to the same amount.
Sure.
But for the time that you are actually on the wall, I think it's like 8 to 11 calories per minute, which is not too far from running.
Yeah. Are you familiar, and maybe not, are you, but, and I'm not either, but I'm wondering if you're familiar with kind of the nutrition strategies, habits, whatever, of some, you know, big climbers like the Alex Honnolds and all those kind of people. Do you have any sense of, you know, what they're doing there? Because even, I mean, again, I'm sure you've watched Free Solo. You know, what was that, like a 3+ hour climb, mm-hmm. right? Or something like that. And of course, these are my thoughts as a dietitian. It's like, was he eating or drinking anything? Like, probably not. Like, the movie doesn't show any of that, obviously. Like, did he just not pee? Like, how does that work? Like, what was going on? I mean, like, probably because since it was a solo, like there was nothing.
I think it showed, and it might have been during one of his practice runs, but the movie definitely shows him at one point getting onto a ledge and picking up a bottle of water that he'd stashed there. So,
okay.
There was something there.
But, like, you think about the actual efforts, or I don't know if, like, any big-name climbers, if you're familiar with, like, what they do. And I ask in part because we've talked a lot about the culture of the sport. And, you know, a lot of the times, not that we're always looking to the pros to shape everything, but, you know, what they do is influential. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious if you happen to know what they do. And maybe the answer is no. I have absolutely no idea what they do. So. But I'm also like, this isn't my sport. Do you have any sense of that?
I'm thinking because, I know, like, everything that I can think of talks more about sort of like day-to-day nutrition. I know, like, Alex Honnold has spent quite a bit of time, you know, as like a vegetarian or mostly sure. vegetarian. But I'm not sure I've actually read anything about like, what do you actually take on a climb, which now
I would love to know that.
Yeah. Yeah, and totally right. To your point about how, you know, a lot of the time things sort of start with the pros and kind of trickle down. This is like a little bit of an aside, but climbing, like rock climbing in particular, is really sort of at an inflection point right now when it comes to REDS, like relative energy deficiencies.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so, you know, so climbing has pretty much always had this like lighter is better.
Oh yeah, I have a whole question about this. Yeah, I mean. But yeah, go ahead. We'll get into it.
Yeah. So the long story short of it is, you know, there have been some pro climbers who have started to come out and say, like, you know, yeah, I dealt with an eating disorder from ages X to Y, and just who have been really vocal about it. I'm actually really excited. Beth Rodden, who was like the it girl in like 2000s, I want to say. She just wrote a book and it's about to be released. And like, I know she goes into a lot of this whole, you know, climbing and body image and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. So I think that's going to be really exciting to read. But, you know, we keep seeing more and more climbers coming out and saying like, hey, we have a problem in our sport. So the IFSC, the International Federation of Sport Climbers, which is like the competitive branch of climbing that happens like in the gym, they mm-hmm. just released a policy for basically screening for REDS.
That's great.
Which is really exciting at like the international competition level. You know, but what I keep thinking of, and every time I see something, you know, a pro climber will write an Instagram post about, you know, hey, we need to do better as a community, blah, blah, blah. Like, this isn't fair for our youth climbers, you know, which I totally get. But I always see those posts shared around. And there always seems to be this sort of air of, yeah, like, this is bad for the pros. But there isn't really that connection between, like, and also amateur climbers are doing all of these same things. And this is a problem, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I work predominantly with recreational athletes, and REDS is like just so prevalent, more so, I would say almost more, not, I mean, not, maybe it's not more than elite pros, whatever, but because recreational athletes don't have all day to take naps and sit around and really take care of themselves, they're training and then they're like running a million miles a minute doing everything else in their life. Right. So I think it's even harder to take care of yourself properly, and people don't always prioritize all the things that they need to be doing. Again, intentionally or unintentionally, but going back, certainly back to weight for a minute. I mean, I talk all the time on the show about weight and REDS, and weight is such a topic of interest. Let's go say that's an understatement, but it's a topic of interest among, you know, all these different sports. But in my mind, and maybe I'm wrong here, but my perception in my limited experience of working with climbers and from what I see and all that, there seems to be an even greater emphasis on weight as it relates to performance among climbers. And I mean, maybe it's in part because they're literally carrying their bodies up a mountain, rock, whatever, you know? So like, obviously there's that aspect, and, you know, weight is such a consideration when it comes to like carrying your nutrition, all of that. It's not that these things aren't relevant for cycling, triathlon, running, like you're still moving your body forward and up a mountain or whatever, but it obviously with climbing, it's a little bit more so. And the weight obsession seems a little bit more prevalent. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about this and how you work with climbers, and especially the recreational climbers, to help them stay healthy and perform well, while also managing this like preoccupation with weight.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about this.
I'm sure you do. I want to hear all of them.
So that basically is the idea that, you know, because rock climbers are going straight up, then you know, because of how physics works, I don't totally understand, you know, basically 100% of what you are carrying, you feel as you carry up, versus something like cycling or running where, you know, yeah, you're going uphill, but it's also, you know, it's not vertical. I don't know. I don't know the physics behind it. but that's absolutely the sort of argument behind it. To the point where I see a lot of climbers who are afraid to build muscle. You know, they struggle with doing strength training because they don't want to build muscle, because that's extra weight, even if it's weight that makes them stronger, that they have to carry up a wall. If we look at the research, it is very, very mixed for any study. And I'll preface all of this climbing nutrition weight research with, this is a very new field of study. There is very little research that has been done in climbers, and even less that has been done in recreational climbers. So most of what we know is looking at elite professional climbers, which, as we know, doesn't always apply to just, you know, some person who's at the climbing gym on a Tuesday night.
Sure. But
what we do see in the research is that about half of the studies say, yes, there is a link between BMI and climbing ability. And the other half say, no, there's no relationship. You know, we have studies showing that, you know, BMI might make a difference, but body fat percentage doesn't, and vice versa. So, which really kind of brings in that question around, well, does it, you know, does adding muscle mass actually have an impact on any of this? The really interesting thing that I always think about when it comes to all of this weight stuff, and, you know, looking at the studies that do show that a lower BMI is associated with climbing harder, is it really is a correlation, not causation kind of thing. You know, elite climbers, professional climbers who are, you know, really like pushing the limits of climbing, are also at a higher risk of having disordered eating and low energy availability. So is it the fact, like, is it the case that weighing less is what makes them a good climber? Or are these really good pro elite climbers really good and they weigh less because they're not eating enough? And then, like, to your point earlier, they're professional climbers, so they get to work with the best PTs. They work with the best coaches. They spend all of their day recovering. That's what I can imagine anyway. Just go for your climb and come back, recover, take a little nap, eat some snacks. I'm sure it is not that way. I know for climbing, you know, there are a lot of climbers who do have, like, full-time jobs on.
Yeah.
But, totally, you know, they have access to all of the best PTs and the best recovery. And so, you know, for a recreational climber, if they had that level of low energy availability and tried to push it as hard as they did climbing, it could be disastrous in a way that it just isn't for the pros and for the elites.
Yeah. And they're also different, again, like there are different types of climbing. Like there is climbing for speed, there's climbing, I mean, there's like with running or cycling or whatever, there are all these different sports within the sport. So I imagine there are some differences there. But I also like with all the other things with weight, yes, it does matter body comp. Like, I think it matters to an extent, but you don't want to push it so far where you're losing power. So like not doing strength training, first of all, it's like hard to build muscles. Like people always have this like belief that they're going to like do a couple bicep curls and suddenly be like Popeye or something. I mean, it just doesn't freaking work that way. But if it does for you, great. But, you know, it's hard to build muscle. You really have to put in the work and eat well. But more so than that, like you have to be strong to, I imagine, climb well, right? Like that's part of it. So that's kind of funny. But I mean, I think this is something that is a challenge in most sports, or in many, you know, definitely in endurance sports, but across many, many sports. You mentioned, you know, that you believe that intuitive eating has a place in sports nutrition with athletes, and you said it isn't a popular opinion. I'm curious why you don't think that. You're most definitely not the only sports idea I've had on the show who works in the intuitive eating space. I'd say personally, like, I maybe incorporate principles of that, but I wouldn't call myself like an intuitive eating dietitian. Like, I don't have the certification. I do sometimes, in very specific situations, work a little bit on weight or body comp, but a lot of the principles of that whole thing I work in. And then, like, listening to your body and all that stuff, super important. And there are some places where we have to be super intentional and we can't always be intuitive. So I'm curious how you work intuitive eating into your nutrition approach with athletes, and, you know, how you feel it's beneficial to the work that you do, and what the drawbacks are to intuitive eating within athlete populations.
Yeah. So I'm going to kind of capitalize on a comment you just made about how with athletes, we have to be intentional about our fueling. Yeah. So with intuitive eating, the 10th principle is gentle nutrition. And I always like to call this principle the cheat code. I think it's the 9th principle. Never mind. Either way, gentle nutrition, I like to call as sort of the cheat code. Which, you know, as someone who is like, no, there's no such thing as cheating on your diet.
Yeah. I was like, wait, what?
But that is where you can pull that intentional eating piece and have it be 100% compatible with the framework of intuitive eating. So it's basically the idea that intuitive eating really teaches you to listen to your body, but gentle nutrition gives you that ability to then say, okay, I just got back from a run. I am not hungry at all. In fact, I feel kind of nauseous and eating sounds terrible, but I know that in order to recover from that run and make sure that I'm not falling behind on my nutrition, I need to eat right now. And that to me is sort of the like magical point where we can say, okay, thanks to gentle nutrition, thanks to that ability to eat intentionally, we can apply intuitive eating to athletes. And I think that's one of the bigger, misconceptions around intuitive eating that I see a lot. And of course, as you mentioned, there, you know, are other intuitive eating dietitians out there. But I would say, like, the most common argument I see against it is basically that, thinking, well, you know, intuitive eating is eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. That I agree, that is absolutely not compatible with being an athlete and fueling adequately. So, you know, it is kind of subtle to tie that in there, but yeah, I think that intentional piece is totally consistent with everything else related to intuitive eating. And then, yeah, as to your other questions around just what benefits does it provide? You know, obviously there is the being in tune with your body piece, being better able to recognize those early signs of, okay, something is a little bit off right now. You know, what do I need to do to modify that? You know, and even just being able to listen to your body enough to recognize, hey, I feel like I'm not recovering very well. You know, my muscles are sore. My workouts feel hard. So just by learning how to listen to your body, you can tune in and pick up those sorts of things. The other major benefit, honestly, and this kind of ties in with a lot of our conversation that we've had already, is just that relationship with food piece. You know, and I think especially for amateur and recreational athletes, you know, maybe you could really buckle down and, you know, take your nutrition to the next step, you know, by doing something that feels a little bit more restrictive and a little bit less free. But at what cost and what benefit are you really getting from that, right? Like, I think at the highest levels of sport, you might find some benefit to, you know, being 1% stronger at your sport. But, you know, for most of us, I think most of us would rather have a healthy relationship with food, healthy relationship with our bodies, and run a marathon that's, you know, 6 minutes slower or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it depends on who you talk to. Yeah. I'm like, the 6 minutes slower piece, I don't know. Some of my clients wouldn't be okay with
it. Yeah, that's
not but right. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Totally. And there are many things that, you know, are just like, and like, if you're a pro, like, yeah, a fraction of a second's a big deal. You know, and you do everything you can to get that edge. And if you're a recreational athlete who's really competitive, it's just doing a cost benefit analysis of, okay, well, is this really worth it to you? And also, like, are we still, whatever is going on, like the question when I work with people is always like, are we protecting your health first and foremost? That comes first. And obviously performance is tied into that, but, you know, like also, are you like miserable and not able to like actually live your life? Because that to me is not sustainable or fun, or it's not something I support. But yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. And with the intuitive eating framework, I'd say for the most part, like that's everything I practice with my clients as well. I just don't, I guess, I mean, I work in some, like a lot of intuitive eating principles. I don't necessarily call myself an intuitive eating dietitian personally, but I mean, I'm pretty much like 95%. Awesome. Is there anything else you want to add to this conversation about nutrition for mountain athletes, and particularly with climbers, that we haven't, you know, touched on, or you think we kind of covered it?
I think we kind of covered it. I mean, you know, we started out with answering the most important question of how do you poop on a climb?
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Or pee. I mean, I imagine like with everything, guys just have it easier, like with peeing, you know, they just whip it out and pee off the side, and us women are just like, well, okay, cool. Yep. This is more challenging. I'm sure there are climbers that are like, fuck it, I'm just gonna pee my pants, whatever, like athletes. but yes, that was the most important question that I had for you. So thanks for guiding me through that. What's on the horizon for you? Do you have any kind of cool things going on that you're training for, or any kind of professional projects, other stuff going on?
Yeah. You know, on the fun side, the training side of things, I got peer pressured into running a 50K in
which one?
Or Jemez Mountains in Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Cool.
Yeah, I am definitely not going to be prepared for that because I was not planning on that. But that'll be fun. And then my big summer goal is I'm doing the Rut Trifecta up in Big Sky in September.
What is that?
Which it is a 3-day, it's one of the kind of like 3-day running festival situation.
Okay.
So Friday is a vertical K, Saturday is a 28K, and Sunday is a 50K with 10,000 vertical feet. So it's a lot of vert for the weekend. I'm pretty excited about that.
Do you camp in between? Like, what do you do?
Hang out.
No, but I mean, like, are you camping on the mountain, or like, where do you stay?
No, we'll just get a, because it's you kind of come back to like the base village.
Got it.
So yeah.
Okay, cool. So you can shower and have some comfort in between your efforts.
Yes, absolutely.
That sounds awesome.
On the professional side of things, I am actually teaching an intuitive eating for climbers workshop at gym in a couple of weeks. So very excited about that. Starting a group program for nutrition for the outdoor athlete that actually starts tomorrow, which is very
exciting. Ooh, congrats. Congrats. Oh, that's awesome.
Thank you.
Programs are hard work, as I have recently discovered, having finally finished mine.
Yeah. You have been a lot of work into that.
Yeah, it's been a lot, but I'm glad it's done and it's there. Awesome. Well, let's go through my quick bites questions and then we'll say goodbye and send you off on your way. What is your favorite pre-workout meal or snack?
Ooh, I'm going to go with peanut butter toast with a banana.
Solid answer. I'm like that and like oatmeal. It's pretty, you know, the two basics in bagel sometimes. Although I don't do bagels anymore because like California bagels are.
Oh yeah. Bummer.
Yeah. Big bummer. Wait, are you from Colorado originally or no?
I grew up in Virginia, but my dad's from Brooklyn and we've got family on Long Island. So
you got the bagel stuff. Yeah, you get it.
Very picky about bagels.
What is your favorite post-workout meal or snack?
Ooh, can I talk about my favorite restaurant to go to after like a long day?
Well, yes.
There is a restaurant in Buena Vista, Colorado. It is pronounced Buena Vista. Don't come at me. anyway, shout out to House Rock Kitchen. They have a bunch of like bowls that are very, very large and they're all inspired by different cuisines. They have a house-made black bean / seed burger that just the patty goes on it, and it is like the most incredible thing ever, and I'm always excited to eat that.
Yum. Are you vegetarian or you just enjoy kind of all foods?
I'm technically pescatarian. I'm picky about my seafood. So
got it. Okay. Got it. I don't know if you enjoy cooking, but if you do, or maybe if you don't, biggest cooking catastrophe if you've had one.
Ooh. I know there's gotta be something, but no.
Or do you live at elevation? I guess is Golden at elevation?
Right about 500 feet. So it's
enough to kind of throw baking off, I imagine, right?
Yeah, I'm not that much of a baker. This okay. isn't a catastrophe, but actually this is like very relevant to all of the things. During the pandemic, when you like couldn't buy baking supplies anywhere, but also everybody was making sourdough. I had sourdough starter going and I really wanted to make banana bread, but I didn't have baking powder. So I actually used some of my sourdough starter in my banana bread and it was phenomenal. Highly recommend.
Oh, so that's not a catastrophe. That was a success story.
Not a catastrophe at all.
But that's also welcome here. Great. I love hearing about cooking successes as well. What's the most exotic or interesting food that you've ever tried?
Ooh, I'm a little bit boring with this one. I have not tried it yet, but I would be interested in trying like crickets or like grasshoppers.
Tried that. It's weird. Crunchy. It was like one day I was wandering around New York City. And like, I don't know, sometimes like they would have these little food trucks, like it was some marketing thing and like they'd be handing out, you know, just free things, whatever. And I think it was like a newspaper or a magazine. They were handing out ice cream, but I guess they were releasing a story about, you know, insects as protein. And as part of the marketing or whatever, they were handing out like, I think it was like some delicious ice cream that I liked, but it was like, you had to choose like crickets. Yeah. Like. And I forget what the choices were, but there were like two or three different insect choices. They would not give you the ice cream unless you took it with all the toppings. So that was how I got that.
That's amazing.
So it's like, I really want my ice cream. I guess I have to try this.
That's amazing. I feel like that could bring up a lot of traumas for kids with bug food.
Yeah. I don't think they were marketing it towards children. I don't remember if like the children were out and about. I mean, it was like in Midtown. It's like, they remember they make kids running around there, you know, it's like all the people in their like lunch break or something. Right. How do you like your eggs cooked? If you eat eggs?
Scrambled.
What's your favorite beverage?
I'm really boring. I really like water.
Oh, such an arty answer. Okay.
No cold water. I do not want ice in it. I just want room temperature water.
I'm the same way. Actually, someone else recently said that to me as well. It was also another room temperatured or heated up water or something like that. Okay. You're not the only one. Unlike my like 4-year-old who like the water has to be like freezing. I don't know why. What are your comfort foods?
The classic Ben and Jerry's, big fan. Mac and cheese. It's all of my answers to these are very boring and like stereotypical.
That's okay. Hey, it's all good.
Big fan of mac and cheese.
What's your favorite Ben and Jerry's flavor?
Ooh. I used to really like one. What was it called? It had an inappropriate name. It was called like these nuts or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They discontinued it, but it was like malted milk balls and pretzels, I think. It was phenomenal.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got it. And last but not least, and maybe this one will be hard for you because you are a multi-sport athlete, top three items of gear that are most essential to your active lifestyle.
Ooh, this is really tough. Okay, I've been thinking about running a lot lately, so I'm just going to like zone in on that.
Okay.
Unnecessarily large running vest to fit all of my snacks.
Which vest do you use?
I have an Ultimate Direction. It's the Adventure Vesta. It's the biggest one. It comes with me for everything. And
mine is very large too. And I definitely do not use like probably like half of the space, but that's okay. I'm like, one day I'm going to do like some sort of like 24 hour, like whatever. And I'll need some space. It's like, what? Like a 12 liter, like something or other. Anyways. Yes. All right. Keep going.
I'm going to go with that. I just bought this season and it was worth every penny and it was kind of a lot of pennies. It is a Rab. I never know if it's Rab or Rob, but they make jackets, but it's the Pro. It's like almost like a mountaineering grade down jacket. But I had a day at 14,000 feet with 50 mile an hour wind like 2 months ago, and I was warm and cozy the whole time.
Lovely.
Yeah,
awesome.
What's my third one? Can I say snacks? Is that a cop out?
No, not at all.
I'm going to go for snacks.
Counts. Awesome.
I'm gonna put Cheez-Its on that list because they have saved me on many occasions.
I've done Goldfish before just because, like, you know, that was what we had around with the kids and whatever. But they're not actually that salty, funny enough. You look at, like, the sodium content of those, and, like, they taste good, and it's a nice, like, flavor changer, kind of mixing it up. Yeah. But then you actually look at the sodium content. It's not. But Cheez-Its, I feel like, have more salt crystals on them, I want to say. I actually haven't looked at the nutrition label, though, so I'm curious how much sodium is in there. But, yes, Cheez-Its are delicious.
They don't have a ton of sodium, but they taste saltier.
Yeah, it's nice to get that kind of, you know, changing up the taste of things. I did my long run yesterday, and I was out there for like almost 4 hours, and definitely had wished I just didn't bring anything salty. It was just like a lot of sweet stuff. So yeah, I was craving the salt at some point. So that's always a nice crunchy, salty things. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can everyone find you online if they want to reach out or do your group nutrition or say hi?
Yeah, probably Instagram is the easiest way. I'm at @AlysaOutside_RD. And I know it's going to be written there, but for anyone listening, Alyssa is spelled A-L-Y-S-S-A.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks for answering all my questions. And I hope you have a great time at your run in May.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome.
That's our show for today. I hope you all enjoyed that one. And if you did, please make sure you hit follow or subscribe wherever you listen. And if you have a minute, I would be so grateful if you could also rate and review my show. I'm really trying to grow my audience, and that would be so helpful. If you're able to support the show financially, I do have a Patreon page, and I'd love to see you over there in my community. Patreon members get some great perks, including free merchandise, huge discounts on my digital downloads, and much more. Thank you so much for your support. And again, please feel free to email me, claire@eatforendurance.com, with any feedback, questions, or topic requests. Thanks so much, and see you guys all next time.